Welcome to Dragons and Jive, episode 4, suckers. I'm Billy D, and alongside me is my co-host, Herman. What's up, brother?
I can't complain, Billy. I'm, enjoying myself, thinking, you know, it's hard to square everything in my brain when we're doing these three issues, because at one point in time, I want to sound all philosophical like Shang-Chi and quote some Confucius. And then, you know, that gets interrupted when my Luke Cage jive starts messing with my thoughts. and then I don't know what Iron Fist got going, but so far he doesn't speak a lot. He's just got this inner rage-fueled monologue. So, no sound. That won't work for the podcast. But yeah, things are going well, brother. So, how about yourself, Mr. B?
Good. Everything's going good. Coming up on a holiday soon here, so looking forward to that.
Again?
Hey, why not?
Yeah, that's cool, man. You gotta take some R&R.
Just a quick one, though. Nothing extended. Just a quick one.
Long weekend, something like that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Yeah, here over in Asia, it seems they've got more national holidays than, you know, the Mandarin has rings on his fingers, but, you know, it's shaping up to be quite interesting. Hey, speaking about the Mandarin, I don't think we've ever talked about, have we? Like, how do you feel about the Shang-Chi movie? I mean, as of this recording, it's dropping this weekend, I think. Are you guys, are you just going to give it a miss, or what's your feelings about the whole Shang-Chi movie thing?
Yeah, from what I've seen, it's definitely not on my radar. It doesn't, you know, even slightly mirror the comic book, so it's not on my list.
Yeah, I think we briefly mentioned the rings that I just referenced as well on our previous episode, but I'm not happy with the fact that they're marrying an Iron Man villain to the Shang-Chi mythology, and also with the whole ring thing, you know, the it would have been hard after the MCU to do just a straightforward, you know, realistic movie, you know, which is most of the Shang-Chi comics are. I mean, he has encounters with the rest of the Marvel U, but basically it's an espionage thriller, the entire series. So how would they have done that after everybody was high on the MCU special effects and, you know, Infinity Stones and everything?
Yeah, that audience isn't going to see Bruce Lee meets James Bond. They're not going to go see that.
No.
So I understand why they did what they're doing, but it's not for me. So hey, if you're into that, go nuts. Go see it.
Yeah. I'm probably gonna see it, but I mean that character for me is not Shang-Chi. I don't know. I mean, they've given him a different angle. He looks Americanized. You know, he's been in the States for a while trying to escape his past, and then he's drawn back into the world. It's, the old world that he came from. It's completely the opposite in the comic book. In the comic book, he's an old world educated type, a babe in the woods, and then he's thrown into this modern world. That's what makes Shang-Chi appealing for me in the comics, not the other way around. So, interesting. Nah, I'm not feeling it. But this comic, though, Billy, that we're discussing today, Hands of Shang-Chi, Master of Kung Fu, number 18. Oh, man, what a comic, huh?
Well, I'll tell you what. Before we even get started, I will say I barely had any, you know, just a few scattershot issues of this title. So since I never had anything consecutive, I only pretty much, you know, checked them out once and read them and, you know, threw them in the bags and boards and in a box somewhere, and they sat there for a while. And when you and I talked about, you know, this comic book, you were, like, over the moon about this comic book. So I thought, well, it must be pretty good. So, you know, I ended up getting this epic collection, and it is slowly becoming one of my favorite Bronze Age comics. It's creeping right up there with my favorites of all time.
Fantastic, dude. Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, it's gonna worm its way into your system here, and it won't let you go, because it really is one of the best Bronze Age comic books. I mean, Doctor Strange is my favorite, but Shang-Chi hit highs in the plot and in the storyline, the overall story, that eclipses Doctor Strange, because Doctor Strange was very much still hampered by the fact that he's in the Marvel Universe, you know, so he has to, well, not hampered, I should say, but it's technically Doctor Strange is a superhero comic, but based in a supernatural universe. So Shang-Chi, no, I mean, completely different. If you're looking for something different, this is it. You know, so you have the best of both worlds in the Marvel Bronze Age. You have the horror, you have, you know, Doctor Strange and the superhero ilk, and then you have obviously the Shang-Chi stuff. And there's no other comic book like it around at the time. You know what I mean, Billy? So, I mean, it very much borrows from the character that Bruce Lee established in Enter the Dragon. You know, where he wasn't just a martial artist. At first, it seems like he was a martial artist who sequestered himself in this, you know, Shaolin temple where he was, you know, training these monks, these young monks in the beginning of Enter the Dragon. But then it turns out he was actually an operative for, you know, an intelligence agency. And he was, every now and then, he's drafted by this agency to take out these drug smugglers or something. And, of course, he's got the revenge angle with his dead sister, you know, in Enter the Dragon. But, you know, that's very much what Shang-Chi's character is based off of. This operative who's also this master of kung fu coming from this checkered past. Or this past which is wrapped up in his father's checkered, you know, mythology. So, wow. It's just, how can you beat it? And then it's got the whole Sax Rohmer angle where all those great pulp characters are being used and thrown in. So that it's got an added dimension to it, which I've never actually explored. I've only read one of the books, you know, of Sax Rohmer, The Insidious Dr. Fu Manchu. And it was a tough read. But I know a lot of folks, if you look at the letter columns, they got way more out of, you know, Steve Englehart. And then later on, of course, Doug Munch. Using things from the books and putting it into the story. So, you know, there's that angle to it too. So it's got so many dimensions that it's definitely a winner. So I'm so glad, Billy, that you're on the monk bandwagon.
Oh yeah, I'm on the bandwagon, all right. I'm jumping on the hype train because it's it is literally a legit, you know, one of the best Bronze Age comics, and for me that means it's one of the best comics ever.
That's right. Now, this is issue 18, and it's a momentous issue because not only is it a fantastic story written by Steve Englehart, one of our favorite Bronze Age writers, or favorite overall writers, I'd say, but it's also got the introduction of artist Paul Gulacy to the title. Now, he would stay on till at least issue 50. You know, Billy, and then of course he would in the very same month in Giant Size Master of Kung Fu, he would be partner with Doug Munch, and then they would continue that partnership in the main title up until issue 50. So yeah, this is some good times, and they hardly ever miss a beat. So get ready for some greatness. So I'm going to give some specs about this issue. First off, the title, of course, Master of Kung Fu, number 18, cover dated June 1974, on sale March 26th, 1974, edited by Roy Thomas. The cover is penciled by Ron Wilson, inked by Frank Giacoya. And this title of the story inside is just Attack, which is basically what it is. It's Shang-Chi going on the offensive against in his personal war against Fu Manchu. So great title, right, Billy? Just a simple, straightforward attack. And of course, written by Steve Englehart, penciled by Paul Gulacy, inked by Al Milgram, lettered by Tom Arkowski, and colored by Petros Skotase. So Billy, what's your synopsis, Twitter style, for this issue?
As Shang-Chi defeats a member of his father's cadre, Sir Dennis approaches Shang-Chi and tells him of his father's next move. We then see the Master of Kung Fu travel to Florida to face down this insidious plot, and the answer is literally explosive.
Hey, wow. Good one. Wow, Great wrap up there to that synopsis, because very apt. And we briefly referenced this issue too in our regular Into the Weird show, right, Billy, where we discussed the next issue following off of this one, where he encounters Man-Thing. But we talked about this issue too. This features one of the most badass Shang-Chi moments ever. And how he can turn defeat into victory just at the drop of a hat with his insane skills. So my synopsis is as follows. Shang-Chi strikes the first blow against Fu Manchu in New York and is sent by Sir Dennis to sunny Florida to foil a delivery of the dreaded soporific mimosa. He falls prey, he himself falls prey to its effects and has to contend with a drugged up dacoit with his hands tied behind his back. A piece of cake for the master of kung fu.
Oh man. Wow, what an issue.
Yeah, you see, the thing with the Shang-Chi issues are, it's not like a traditional superhero issue where you know he's going to make it. Sometimes you think, damn, this is, he's not going to make it. And then when he does, it's not implausible. I mean, for a man for his skills, but you're wondering, how are they going to do it? It's kind of like, you know, Batman or Mr. Miracle having to escape a devious trap. And you want to see how the writer's going to get him out of this, right, Billy? So you still know he's going to make it. But you definitely have more of a sense of fear for his life or for him being injured or maimed. Because he's not invulnerable. He's human. And yet he possesses this amazing survivability, this fantastic sense of, you know, this fantastic skill set. That's always interesting to portray on the page. So let's talk about this, Billy. First off, the cover by Ron Wilson and Frank Giacoya. What did you think?
It's a good cover, not great. I do like Shang-Chi, you know, being trussed up, and even though his hands are tied behind his back and he is breaking those bonds, he's still in the midst of kicking the crap at two guys. And, you know, you have Fu Manchu there with his hand raised in the air, like, all authoritative. Shang-Chi looks a little sinister himself, though, on the cover.
Yeah, the way his eyes are drawn. Man.
Yeah, but, I mean, again, good cover. I don't think it's great, but it's pretty good. The problem is, when you turn that cover open and you see the splash page blows it out of the water completely.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. That's Paul Gulacy's first image, you know, that you see when you open up on the splash page. And the cover, the biggest problem I have with the cover is the fact that Fu Manchu does not look like Fu Manchu. You know, tangentially, it could be Fu Manchu, but it's not the way he's drawn traditionally in the comics or...
No.
Yeah, but still, I mean, a great cover. Not great, I would say. Like you said, good cover, just not one of the greats. But a very action-packed cover, so that's good. You want that when you have a Kung Fu comic. And the classic Shang-Chi corner box art just, you know, does it for me always. So I'm not going to give this cover a thumbs down, but definitely not one of the best. Then you've got Attack on the first opening splash page. You've got it throws you into what it's in medias res, right? In the middle of the story. Shang-Chi... You don't even know what's happening here, but you want to know what's happening because it's so awesome. Yeah. He's in the middle of a battle with this dacoit strangler. Now, the dacoit, I think, traditionally from India, but this guy is very much drawn to be oriental. And probably he's got the skill sets of a dacoit because he's got this strangling apparatus which he uses to strangle people. The dacoit bandits, of course, known for strangling their victims and then robbing them. You know, so this guy's got some strangling skills, right, Billy? That's what Shang-Chi's up against.
Yeah, he has that weapon that, I don't know what the hell it's called, but it's like, you know, kind of attached to his wrist, and it's got a thing that he can, like, slap over the top of your head and choke the crap out of you with.
Yeah, it's kind of like a wire noose attached to his wrist. Yeah, you're right. And Shang-Chi...
It's cool.
Yeah, it's really cool. I mean, Shang-Chi gets the better of this guy in the first half of the fight, but then... the guy manages to wrap that noose around his neck, and it's almost over for Shang-Chi there. Luckily, he got his fingers in between the noose, and then he's probably lucky it's not piano wire, because damn.
Ooh.
And then after that, you know, he almost passes out. He almost blacks out, and then he remembers the past, what, the last 5 minutes or so before he encountered the dacoit bandit, the dacoit fighter. And he decided to strike the first blow against Fu Manchu by infiltrating his office building in New York, entering into this China town segment of it, and then attacked by this dacoit. Now, this dacoit does mention he's been waiting a couple of months or weeks or something to attack Shang-Chi. That's his only duty, to stay there to wait for Shang-Chi to arrive.
Yeah, it's crazy.
talk about fanatical dedication. We'll see some more fanaticism from him later on in the issue from this decoy guy.
He says he's been, I have waited at this entrance for 46 days to kill you.
Yeah. Jeez.
That's wild.
Wow. Determined little bugger. And then, well, this guy's big, actually. What's his name? Satama. We'll learn later. He's got a name. Satama the Decoy. But yeah. Shang-Chi, he regains consciousness. Well, he was almost blacked out there. So he comes back to his senses. And then this is, I don't know how he did this, how he took this guy out. But basically, he's being strangled, right, Billy? What does he do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's being strangled and can't get this, like, noose off of his neck. So while he has a hold of it, then he grabs a hold of this guy's, you know, the front of his, like, uniform there, gi, whatever you want to call it, and flips his legs up around and grabs the guy's head between his legs and, like, flips the guy and slams his head, like, head first into the concrete there, and the guy's half out of it, and then he double karate chop to the carotid arteries and knocks the guy completely out, and then uses his own noose to hang him upside down.
Whoa. Talk about indignation there. And then he leaves a letter. He leaves a note for his father. And what does that note say, Billy?
It just says, first move, Shang-Chi.
So this is very much a game of chess. At least that's how they're seeing it between Shang-Chi and his dad. Now, so Shang-Chi does, in his inner monologue, or in the narrative captions, which are basically his thoughts, he does mention that he can't defeat his father head on, but he has to fight a war of attrition, you know, like guerrilla warfare almost, attacking and then disappearing with each strike. And that's how he's going to whittle down his dad's forces. So when he exits the building, though, who does he meet in an alley?
Yeah, he's bumps into his old buddy Sir Dennis Nayland Smith and Black Jack Tar as well. And he kind of says to him, like, almost like, hey, let's work together to try to stop Fu Manchu. And then, oh, I love this, how, you know, Nayland Smith says, you know, I've been fighting him since the first time I saw him in 1911. Yeah. And then you see this flashback panel, and whoa, man, is that so good. Gillespie, man, what a master.
Yeah, young Sir Dennis in this flashback panel, looking at Fu Manchu standing in this doorway in China somewhere with this, it's brilliant. It's got a dreamy-like effect to it, but the architecture is very detailed. And yeah. Sir Dennis, man, handsome dude, you know. So, wow, loving it. Very good panel there. And yeah, Gulacy just gets better and better as this issue gets along, right, Billy? I mean, the way he draws frown lines or facial details and expressions on faces, it's incredible.
Yeah.
And you know, then they get into this discussion where Shang-Chi says he won't be Sir Dennis's weapon because he wouldn't be his father's weapon, but he will, you know, accept Sir Dennis's information and advice. So Sir Dennis says, well, there's a shipment of unknown cargo that your father's got coming into Florida tonight, so you might want to check that out. I can fly you there if you need if you need some form of travel. And Shang-Chi just says, no, thank you. I shall rely upon myself. So he's going to make it all the way from New York to Florida before the end of the night. But he does, right, Billy? What does he do?
Well, he sneaks onto a plane. I mean, it's literally like a 3-hour plane ride, I think, from New York to Florida.
Yes,
yeah, possible. So it's pretty quick. So he just hot foots it over to the airport, and really, again, like a 1/3 splash page of the airport and all these jets on the runway and Shang-Chi looking down at them. And then he sees his opening where there's a baggage guy and he's picking up the baggage to kind of put into the baggage area. And Shang-Chi, while he turns his head, slips right onto the plane through the little baggage thing there. And it's like, you think about it, that's completely possible, especially back then.
Of course. Now this is where, back then the security was a lot less, it was very lax compared to today's. But, you know, Billy, look at that first, you know, large panel on that page where Shang-Chi's looking out at the airfield or at the airport runways. He, that looks like, that's what Gulacy excelled at. It seemed that sometimes he would draw a portrait or something, or a landscape, and it would be perfect if you just hung it on your wall, you know, as art.
Oh, yeah.
But there's still the sense of movement. I mean, the wind whipping Shang-Chi's hair, his turban, his sash, you know, that he's got tied around his waist. His clothing even seems to be moving in this wind at this airport.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he walks and steals onto this plane. But every panel looks like it could be like a masterpiece just hanging in a museum or something. You know, yeah. And then there's some silent panels too, like the airplane just taking off. And that's when Shang-Chi, you know, slips into his dreamlike meditation.
Yeah, it's funny when he's like creeping onto the plane through that baggage area when it shows the baggage guy in the forefront. I don't know what the original issues look like, but in the Epic Collection here, it almost looks like the baggage guy is like winking at the camera.
yeah, it looks like it. It's the same. Well, I'm not reading my originals here. I'm reading it in the you know, omnibus, but basically it's the same. It's the guy looks like he's winking or something. And it's
weird. I guess he's supposed to be checking his watch, maybe. He has his watch out in his wrist. Maybe that's what he's supposed to be doing, but it almost looks like he's winking. It's kind of funny.
Could also, could be that he's got a lazy eye, you know, or, you know, eye trouble.
Could be.
Who knows?
Mm-hmm. But yeah, then Shang-Chi gets on there, and like I said, starts meditating as the plane goes up.
Now, Billy, flip between this page and the next page. Now, look at the first top two panels. You know, the panel that we just discussed with Shang-Chi looking out at the airport. Next page. Shang-Chi again from an elevated position looking out over this cove and this...
Yeah, it's just in reverse, left to right instead of right to left, but
holy
my gosh.
God, look at the... It's so beautiful. The moonlight on the water, the seagulls flying over the ocean, the little dock. They've got this compound that Fu Manchu has, which is an old fort located on the cliffs here where he's going to... which he owns and where the delivery is going to happen with this cargo ship dropping off this contraband. And then you've got this Doctor Strange moment where Shang-Chi says, "Well, this Florida is beautiful. Never have I seen such a tree. And what is this? Oh ho! A lizard!
A strong beast yearning like all creatures to be free."
Yeah. "Fear not, lizard. I only wish to learn of you."
That's kind of creepy, just like that Doctor Strange moment when he was like, "This lizard means everything to me."
Yeah,
and he
exactly.
started crying.
That's what I was thinking about, man. Oh, it was brilliant, brilliant. And then Shang-Chi, he lets the little lizard go when he sees the, he hears first the engines of this cargo ship approaching, and then he lets the lizard go, and then we see another little animal being highlighted in the next panel because Shang-Chi's now staring down at the ship docking. And then Fu Manchu is on this vessel, but the first inkling we get of him is his little pet lemur, which is a pico. It's not really a monkey. It's a lemur, I think. Or maybe a capuchin, maybe a capuchin monkey. Maybe not a lemur.
Yeah, I'm not sure what it is. It's some kind of primate or something, but yeah, he says... "What is it, Pico? Does your ancient brain detect a menace? Here, a nut for you."
now that itself is a comment filled with meaning or possible meanings, right, Billy? It could be because later on you'll learn as you go through the series that Fu Manchu, brilliant scientist and biologist that he is capable of experimenting on animals, kind of like Dr. Moreau, you know, from the H.G. Wells classic, The Island of Dr. Moreau. He's capable of experimenting on animals and changing them. I mean, we saw that with the gorilla that attacked Shang-Chi in his debut issue. You know, the very first episode that we had, we discussed that. Fu Manchu has these animal guardians, but he's capable of experimenting on them and enhancing their intelligence, enhancing some grotesque features that they might already have and then... you know, making them even more grotesque, and then also creating these animal hybrids, which is very disturbing. And they will plague Shang-Chi throughout the series. Not often. You know, Fu Manchu has a cadre of assassins with gimmicks, you know, that are more prevalent throughout the series. You know what I mean? But animal horror certainly happens in this series very, very frequently. So we'll see that happening soon, Billy. This is probably Pico. Now, this ancient brain comment might mean that Pico, he refers to him as an animal that's been around longer than humans have in our current form.
Right.
But it could also be that he has implanted someone's brain into this animal a loyal servant, perhaps, and now Pico serves him with heightened intelligence. It could be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I love how, like, all of Fu Manchu's subordinates, they all, like, address him as if he's, like, you know,
a god.
Not even royalty, like, yeah, like, something above royalty, even. Like, he's like, where are the trucks I ordered? And this guy comes over and bows and says, oh, Celestial One, this odious person presents himself for your righteous wrath. The vehicles to transport our cargo are delayed for at least 2 hours by the need to avoid American authorities.
Exactly. Now, Fu Manchu's very magnanimous here, right, Billy? Because usually mm-hmm. he's merciful, because usually he will kill someone when he's disappointed, or when they failed him, or he will, you know, make them undergo hideous bodily transformation to serve him in a different form. But here he just lets it slip. But, you know, the fun part is what this guy says. Now, I'm going to let you speak about the first panel on the next page, because you posted that on Twitter and that got some great reactions, right, Billy? But the servant says, the Americans have increased their vigilance of late in an attempt to destroy the traffic in drugs. Now, this is what Sir Dennis also thought. He thought this cargo ship is transporting opium or something, which was which Fu Manchu was known for, you know, in the dawn, I should say, of the 20th century. You know, when he first mm-hmm. encountered Sir Dennis, he was also an opium smuggler. But Fu Manchu is taken aback by this comment, or he's insulted that the Americans would think he's smuggling mere drugs. What does he say in the next panel, Billy?
He says, drugs? What? Marijuana? Hashish? If the fools only knew what Fu Manchu is bringing into their backward land.
Their backward land. Now, this shows, you know, his disdain for the West, right, Billy? He does really mm-hmm. see the West as backwards. Even with all the scientific achievements, for him, that is as nothing to his alchemy and science and, you know, his depraved studies in forbidden, you know, fields. And, you know, because he does, in fact, have access to science that seems, you know, science fiction. But he prefers mm-hmm. the biological sciences, or something akin to magic almost, you know, but it's more alchemy. Mm-hmm. So yeah. he sets his faith in that. And he thinks that the old world's better than the new. He thinks they're decadent. And, you know, he addresses the sailors, and he says, you know, they should keep unceasing watch, because this is a precious cargo. And he's got this feeling that his son, Shang-Chi, might be nearby. Pico senses it too, right? So, of course, it proves him right, because Shang-Chi, he's since dove beneath the waters of the bay, and he swam towards the ship, and he climbs mm-hmm. up the guy rope and then steals aboard the ship. And he immediately goes into the cargo hold, opens up the fuel containers, which is there, because seemingly it looks like Fu Manchu's transporting gasoline or something.
Right.
And that proves to be Shang-Chi's undoing, because the smell of the real gasoline on the ship has blanketed mm-hmm. the smell of what is actually being transported in these containers. Because once he opens it, Billy, it's the mimosa drug that his mm-hmm. father uses as a type of soporific, but it's also a mind control substance. The more you're exposed right. to it, the more your will is withered and worn away, and so you're subject to Fu Manchu's control. And that could also explain why so many people are these fawning, you know, these fawning toadies when it comes mm-hmm. to serving Fu Manchu, because many of them have probably been subjected to this mimosa drug. And Shang-Chi falls mm-hmm. prey to a massive dose of mimosa fumes right mm. in the face, right, Billy? He passes out. What a great mm-hmm. panel there by Paul Gulacy. Do you see when he collapses, right, Billy? His hand clangs on one of the barrels. And then the very next panel, he's completely... It almost looks like he's melting into the deck. You know, mm-hmm. but it's just him losing all muscle control.
Yeah, his motor functions are just, you know, crazy out of whack, but... Yeah, I mean, and it's crazy too, because I think to myself, mimosa and all these things, I'm thinking this, you know, Fu Manchu, he probably lend a couple of barrels of this to, like, you know, the CIA for down in Gitmo or something.
Oh, damn. Damn, 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 oh, damn. I wouldn't put that past him. You know,
I should have said that, or we're probably being wiretapped right now from me saying that.
No. I mean, this is ancient history. Plus, we're talking about a fictional character here for you folks at the CIA there.
Yeah,
well, they'll have to, I'm hoping they'll have to subscribe to our Patreon to listen to us if the CIA I'm hoping.
Well, they probably have Skype bug. But anyway, yeah. Oh, man, that next panel, though, that is a masterpiece. And if you think about it, it probably didn't take, you know, Galassi more than 5 minutes to draw this panel. And it's very limited colors. But, oh, look at that panel. Do not resist the mimosa, my son. Do not resist it. And you have Shang-Chi's kind of like spacing out and tripping out, and the walls are starting to get all crazy. It's almost like he's on a trip, like he's eating some mushrooms.
Yeah, the sweat's breaking out on his brow. His mouth is gaping in horror, and he sees Fu Manchu through the doorway. And Fu Manchu has the swirling effect around him, obviously, you know, denoting Shang-Chi's loss of vision here. But it looks like a candle flickering, or you looking through a candle, looking at an image behind it, and the way it distorts that image. This is basically
incredible.
How Fu Manchu looks like this melting wax candle with little Pico on his shoulder there. Whoa, even the doorway looks like it's melting around it, giving him this type of horror effect, right, Billy?
And if that wasn't enough, you turn the page. Oh. Holy smokes. This needs to be a poster, big time.
Because basically the previous panel had Fu Manchu saying, do not resist the effects of the mimosa. Do not resist its. And then, you know, what he's saying is leads into the sort of like the caption or the title of the next splash page, hallucinations. And then we'll speak on that. That is masterful art by Galassi here.
Yeah, so it's almost like it says hallucinations across the top in like red and orange. And then Shang-Chi and Fu Manchu are opposite sides of the page. And there's this dragon in between them. And then these two creature-like hands holding them up like almost like they're on pedestals. Hmm. And a bunch of the gas cans with the mimosa in between them. This crazy lizard. And then it's all on this like island that's based like a skull shape.
Skull, yeah.
So crazy.
And look at the one eye socket has the lizard. A giant monstrous lizard crawling out. Now, obviously, that's informed by Shang-Chi's encounter with the lizard. His first ever encountered with the lizard, it seems, previously. So this has obviously, you know, been cemented in his mind. But now you've got this lizard crawling out of the one socket. And out of the other socket, there's a skeletal hand. You know, whoa! And Billy, did you see one of the cans of mimosas, the one that he grabbed onto when he collapsed? It spilled. That can and a couple of other cans are in this dream as well. But the one can that spilled, the mimosas dripping into the socket of the skull. Wow.
Oh my gosh.
And then you've got some
insane
flying lizards there in the background. You've got a turbulent sea, like you say, on which the skull island is situated. And the dragon god or monster that's holding them up almost looks like he's, you know, a balancing scale, like a scale, you know, balancing the two of them. Right now, they're evenly balanced. And then Shang-Chi's got his sash and this amazing detail to the folds in his clothing.
Wow.
Fu Manchu has the same, but instead of a sash, he has the smoky effect, you know, as his belt. It's just incredible. It's amazing. And you know, Shang-Chi's filled with vitality and life, you know, based on his color. But Fu Manchu is this vampiric, pale, sickly-looking dude. Who's contemplating some sinister doing. So now you see the contrast between the two. Fu Manchu is very much a villain of the mind. That's why he's got his hand on his chin, right, Billy? Where Shang-Chi has got his Kung Fu pose, which is he's more of a physical, you know, fighter. So Fu Manchu, it just shows the deviousness versus the, you know, the directness of Shang-Chi's approach. And then the very next panel has Shang-Chi recovering from his illusions after he's kicked in the head by one of Fu Manchu's servants.
A goon.
And then we realize his hands are tied behind his back. And this goon's words are slowly, I mean, Shang-Chi's still affected by this mimosa. He would still be affected by this well into the next issue where we see Man-Thing. You remember, Billy? This Mimosa's not leaving his system anytime soon.
No.
So Shang-Chi's still drugged up. He's not himself. The words are just coming into existence here, spoken by this goon. And then Fu Manchu approaches. And it seems that this goon must be a Russian strongman or something, because Fu Manchu addresses him as Raskov. And Shang-Chi's, you know, inner monologue is even affected by this drug, right? He says, "Words, no words are reborn to my ears." Wow, what a great line there. My mind clears briefly. So Fu Manchu has this, he rails against Shang-Chi, saying that you've just come to your death, my son, because this is it between us. You're going to die. I'm going to wipe you from existence. You've interfered with me for the last time. You are a disappointment to me. All of that.
Yeah.
And then he also discusses his plan. He, like all good villains do, he says that he's going to release the Mimosa drug. Well, he's going to sort of pour it into the gasoline supply of Greater America. And then once it's used in cars, the fumes will have the Mimosa fumes, you know, basically bleeding out of the exhausts, and in a couple of months the entire America will be breathing Mimosa fumes, placing them firmly under Fu Manchu's control. Now, wow, this is a massive scheme on a very large scale, right, Billy? This is Dr. Doom-esque, Red Skull level, even more. I'd say Fu Manchu can teach those guys a thing or two about evil schemes.
Oh, they show him at just as he was in you know, the novels, and I've only bought one of them and, you know, skimmed through it, but, you know, reading up on it, you know, Fu Manchu is like hyper intelligent kind of guy that, you know, he has all his ducks in a row. He's two steps ahead of everyone. He's like a master chess player.
Exactly. He's always, like you say, a couple of steps ahead. And Shang-Chi, he doesn't think that far ahead, but you can see he's his father's son. He also has a fantastical mind.
Oh yeah.
But he doesn't think in devious ways. He's very much innocent. He would rather forego being devious and rather find a way that he would call the way of the warrior, the true path to success, which is the straight and narrow in his case, which sometimes works against him, most of the time actually. You know, the fact that he won't match his father's cunning, deviousness with his own deviousness, but he is cunning in his own way.
Yeah.
Now, Billy, one thing Fu Manchu didn't reckon with is Shang-Chi's almost supernatural Kung Fu skills here, because after he... Well, this is a great line I quickly want to read here. You know, this is how Fu Manchu ends their conversation. He says, you know, he's got the president of this combine that he's going to approach, and then he's going to get his agreement to, you know, combine the oil with the Mimosa, or the gasoline with the Mimosa. And then Shang-Chi says, then what'll happen to the president? And Fu Manchu says, well, dead, of course. He'll be dead. His usefulness will have ended. Like this conversation. Like the usefulness of this conversation, Shang-Chi. And that's it. That's the end. And now, you know, he's going to kill Shang-Chi in a very creative way. Now, Billy, the next panel is... The next page is just...
This is crazy.
Incredible. What happens?
So, yeah, he points to someone behind Shang-Chi, and a figure walks forward, and it's the guy from the beginning.
The dacoit, you know, the strangler.
Fought. The dacoit that he had trussed up. Somehow he got that guy and got him down here. And not only is he going to fight Shang-Chi, but then all of a sudden, the guy says, anything you may desire, praised one. And our buddy Fu Manchu says, then, bow your head and receive four drops of another one of my chemical discoveries. I should like to observe its effects. And he puts this like dropper and drops it on this guy's head, and it starts making him go nutty here. And Shang-Chi's thinking to himself, I feel heat radiating from him. And then Fu Manchu says, you know, it's this new chemical formula I concocted, and it's going to give the guy like super speed, like not flash level speed, but like, what does he say,
three or four times? Yeah, three times his usual speed, and it will eventually kill him. And it will be excruciating, his death. But before that time, he will be superhuman, and now he's gonna beat Shang-Chi up, you know, beat him to death, basically.
Kill him, yeah.
Kill him, and Shang-Chi's got his hands tied behind his back, plus he's still addled by the effects of the Mimosa drug. And then look at that last panel as the dacoit bandit approaches Shang-Chi. Billy, that final panel of these evil cronies of Fu Manchu himself and little Pico all laughing with sinister glee. Holy crap. Okay, this reminds me of like the most evil group of bandits you've ever seen in your life. Being drawn manga style, but with a lot more detail than manga can ever impart. I mean, something out of that One Piece, you know, manga, cartoon and comic book One Piece, you know, about the pirates. They've got very sinister looking folks drawn, but not with this level of detail. But basically, these characters look similar to them. Whoa!
Oh yeah, they're really creepy looking, and you only see half of Shang-Chi or Fu Manchu's face. But it's, man, is it creepy and detailed, and oh, it looks fantastic.
Look at the vein popping out on his right temple there, and his pointy ears, his, you know, mustache. And beard. And then Pico laughing with sinister glee in his animal-like way. Jeez.
Oh, man, and then look at that splash page, though. Oh, my gosh.
It's a splash page. Yeah, but it's a protracted fight scene without any panel borders. So yeah, it's a splash, but it's got all these little individual scenes of Shang-Chi versus this dacoit. Now, at first, the dacoit is getting the better of Shang-Chi because, like you say, he moves at superhuman speeds. Shang-Chi's hands tied behind his back. Plus, he's, you know, not himself because of this drug. But then, you know, he says, you know, I am like a tortoise to him as this guy is beating him up. But then he says, but to myself, I'm a tortoise with knowledge.
He high kicks the guy right in the face.
Kicks him in the face, knees him in the solar plexus, and then another kick to the chin. He got that sweet chin music. Mm-hmm. And then a headbutts him in the chest. And then another headbutt in the chin. Holy crap. Yeah. Shang-Chi, it's amazing, right, Billy? And this guy's got superhuman speed. But then the guy, chooses... I think he realized he couldn't defeat Shang-Chi here. But it's also his own pain. Oof. What happens, Billy? Speak on that.
Oh, this is nasty. Yeah, like you said, I think the guy realized he's not going to be able to defeat Shang-Chi, and he's going to just die this horrible death from that drug he dripped onto his head. Hmm. So he grabs a torch and shoves it onto his face. Because of the pain in his head from those drops. And his whole face and head are just completely on fire. And he says, let me die now. And he goes jumping out. And he jumps through a window. And there's a sign right outside the window that says, gunpowder.
Now, this is something that Fu Manchu did not expect. He didn't expect this guy, this dacoit, to go insane from the pain and then jump into, well, first immolate himself with a torch and then jump through this gunpowder shack window. And then this massive explosion, but, you know, grom, right? And then what? This is the most badass Shang-Chi moments ever. Billy, I'm going to let you talk about it because I talked about it on our regular Into the Weird episode. Now, what happens? What does he do? This is incredible.
So the blast knocks him down and like out of the way a little bit, but he grabs a torch with his teeth, jumps up into like the higher elevation, almost like where he was before with the lizard, and looking down at the ship, he then kind of like drops or spits the torch out of his mouth, kicks it with his foot, and then dives away, and he kicks it, and it goes right into the hatch that led down to where the gas tanks were with the gas and the mimosa, and crack a whoop, and the whole ship goes up.
the level of skill needed to do that, Billy, to leap off, to kick a torch off of a cliff. Well, to catch, you know, I'm not even sure it was a torch. I think it was a burning brand from the explosion that caught in his mouth. And then he ran to the edge of this cliff and kicked it and managed to kick it into this small hatch. This manhole, while jumping off of the cliff, leaping into the water, and then what happens? Kraka whoomp. The entire ship explodes and sinks into the sea. All of this mimosa drug lost. Mm-hmm. And Fu Manchu standing on the cliff on that final page. He can't believe it. He's railing. He says, "Oh, I'm gone. Both of my schemes and my son. But my son will escape his watery tomb. He's too well trained to die from a fall. The authorities will be alerted to my scheme." But you can see he's incensed. He's insane with anger here. And then he sends these two assassins to hunt down Shang-Chi. Well, they actually send themselves, right? They say, "Yes, oh celestial one." What do they say, buddy?
Yeah, it's funny. He says, "Unless your faithful servant once of death reach Shang-Chi before he reaches the authorities, and we shall. It is sworn. It is sworn."
Exactly. Now, later we'll find out, like we did in our discussion where Shang-Chi, you know, encounters a Marvel character in the next issue. These two assassins are Dahar and Jekin. Now, they are some of Fu Manchu's personal bodyguards and assassins. So, they're highly trained. They're almost on Shang-Chi's level. And of course, they're going to hunt him down through the swamps of Florida. Now we know who hangs out in the Everglades. We know which Marvel character hangs out there. So, you know, Shang-Chi will encounter him. But if, you know, if you listeners want to treat yourselves to an old episode, why not? But you've probably already listened to it. You know, but go check out our discussion, you know, that you and I had, Billy, on, you know, Shang-Chi teaming up with this Marvel character. I'm going to give you the show number right now. I'm quickly here on our feed. I think that was, a while back already, right, Billy?
It was, yeah.
I think it was episode 25. Oh, no, it was from the beginning of this year, January 27th, right? That's when the show dropped of... Wait a minute. No, that was ages ago. That was 2019.
Yeah.
Can you believe it, Billy?
Yeah.
What? Okay, that's No, it wasn't. It was this year. Sorry. 2021. I'm just screwing myself up here. So episode 25, Much Ado About Man Thing, and I'm wrong about that too. I'm wrong about that. But no, that was our Spider-Man Man Thing crossover, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So which one is this? Let's have a look here.
I think it's episode 21.
Okay, could be.
We did Master of Kung Fu 19, and then we also did the Daredevil 114, which was a two-man thing story.
You're right. Swamp Tripping and Death Stalking. That's it. From 2020. Mm-hmm. That's from August of last year.
A year ago.
Yeah, a year ago, basically. Yeah, to the date.
Mm-hmm.
So we discussed that issue. Yeah, so check out episode 21, Swamp Tripping and Death Stalking, on our regular feed if you want to listen to us talking about the next issue. Which is insane. Man-Thing and Shang-Chi teaming up against Dahar and Jekin. And we've got a cameo by David Carradine, sort of. Not really David Carradine.
Well, without the name, but kind of him, yeah.
Yeah, the man from the Kung Fu TV series himself, sort of. So, believe, fantastic issue. Loved it. It's going to be hard to beat this one. We've got two other great issues to talk about still, but I'm saying this one, hands down, already our favorite. It's in a class of its own.
It really is. It really is. It was already before Gallese came on board, and now that he's there, it's going to be hard for the other two books to unseat this for me.
definitely. But, you know, let's get to them, because we've got some very, very funny moments in the next two issues. But also some pretty gruesome scenes as well, and good storytelling. I would say there's more of a detective style plot in the Luke Cage issue we're going to be talking about, and in the Iron Fist issue it's more of a fleshing out of one of the villains. We're going to learn an origin story there of a sort. Mm-hmm. All three of these issues have a different appeal to me, but the Shang-Chi one's definitely the best of the bunch.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Billy, let me give a few specs on our next issue. Of course, this is the badass steel-fleshed, you know, hero of Harlem himself, of Hell's Kitchen, of Harlem. And and that is Mr. Luke Cage, the hero for hire.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to be discussing issue number 4 of Luke Cage. And this one was published Well, it was cover dated December 1972, but on sale September the 12th, 1972. And edited by Roy Thomas. The cover is by Billy Graham. And the title of the story, Cry Fear, Cry Phantom. And writer Archie Goodwin, of course, penciled by Billy Graham, inked by Sid Shores, lettered by John Constanza. Now, same as the Shang-Chi issue we discussed, you can find this in recent Epic collections, right, Billy? You've got the Luke Cage collection from Marvel called Retribution, which collects the first 20 or so issues. And then you've got the Shang-Chi collection you mentioned, Weapon of the Soul, which is the other Epic collection. You can read it that way. I'm reading it in my Masterworks, Luke Cage Hero for Hire Masterworks, Volume 1. And the Shang-Chi one I was reading in the Omnibus. But this is a fantastic issue, great cover, but still not on the level of the Shang-Chi. So, Billy, what do you have for the synopsis here for Luke Cage, Hero for Hire, number 4?
Okay, after falling asleep for just a few short minutes, Cage is awakened and then assaulted by a phantom. But this is no ordinary ghost, and it's going to take some Sherlock Holmes-style sleuthing for the Hero for Hire to solve this mystery.
which is true. This is Luke, earning his keep as a sort of private eye. He's not a private eye. He's a Hero for Hire. But sometimes, you know, work comes his way, which is very much Sam Spade style, you know, level tasks that he has to complete. And this is definitely one of those. And, you know, Luke being based out of a marquee theater, you know, that's his office in this old, movie theater. That's very Sam Spade style for me, you know, very private eye from the 1930s or 40s. Right, Billy?
Yeah.
I think. I mean, it's just a great place to have an office for a private eye. So you're going to have these clients showing up. This is not the case, though, because the case sort of comes to Luke before the client does. But we'll get into that. My synopsis is as follows. Luke and all the residents of Marquee Row are terrorized by the Phantom of 42nd Street. Hired by a Mr. Brunt to solve the case, Luke plunges into a world of acrobatic dwarves, gigantic Haitian strongmen, and sinister plots of murder decades in the making. So that's it. So we've got a heap of fun here. Yeah, man. We've got the carnival, the carnies showing up in this one. We've got, murder. Oh, it's great. It's like an Agatha Christie meets Blackula meets Foxy Brown. I don't know.
One of those crazy movies, yeah.
Meets the Maltese Falcon. Let's throw that in there as well.
Oh, man. But yeah, that cover's pretty good, though. What do you think of this one? I think it's decent. I like it quite a bit.
I love Billy Graham's covers. I love his interiors. I love Billy Graham. And this is a fantastic cover. The way Billy Graham draws faces as well, it's very, very, very distinct. Not it's the same as Paul Gulacy, but look at Luke's face there, Billy. It's like such a classic, you know, angry face, but it's definitely the face of a hero. This is a determined face. And then the musculature on Luke is so detailed and impressive.
Yeah.
This guy is a chunk of beef waiting to beat the butcher to death. And then you got, you know, this phantom villain in the comic. He looks very sinister. He looks like something out of Ralph Bakshi. You know, the animator, the 1970s movie Wizards and many other things. He really looks like a Ralph Bakshi drawing. And then you've got this cop or security guard or something sprawled beneath the phantom's feet. And this guy's hunchback. Well, the cop's not hunchback. The phantom's hunchback. Wow. And then the logo, or not the Luke Cage logo, which is great in and of itself. I mean, the title of the comic at the bottom of the cover, The Phantom of 42nd Street. Wow, that's written really well. And it really contrasts well with the blue. You know, it's written in yellow, same as Luke Cage's colors. And it's written in yellow against a background of blue. This is just a fantastic cover, color-wise and, you know, the art-wise with the pencils.
Yeah, I feel like on the covers that they switched up the color of, like, you know, the border a lot. You know, there's the you know, kind of covers where it's like a photo, you know, in the middle of the border. And they switched it up. Sometimes it was red, sometimes it was blue. And I think this looks pretty cool, the blue.
It's damn good. Yeah, this is one of the better color contrasts I've seen on the series, but mm-hmm. most of them's great because Luke has a very distinctive color scheme,
yeah.
very similar to Dr. Fate from over at DC. You know, the blue and yellow, it works really well,
right?
And then the metal, shiny metal bits that Luke has, his headband or tiara, his armbands, his belt, his chain like belt, that all works too.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, we see this ghost, this phantom guy, hurling a pinball machine or a arcade machine at Luke. One of those with the shotguns you have to shoot some of the,
yeah,
I don't know,
one of those games, yeah, those like games. a game of chance, yeah.
So they're fighting in this arcade or something, and mm-hmm. It sort of happens in the comic, but not really. But this there's definitely this scene, you know, in the interiors. It's just in a totally different setting. And then, right. Great cover, Billy. Like, look at this. It almost looks like the machine's exploding against Luke's back.
Mm-hmm. Some of the pieces are flying off up into the logo. Yeah, this is pretty cool.
Oh, I love it. Love it. Great cover.
Mm-hmm.
Probably my favorite of the three comics covers, cover-wise. And then Luke's, classic corner box art up there with him, you know, shouting or railing at the man or at whomever he's going to, give a beating to. That's just a great corner box logo or piece of art. So yeah, then the opening page, Billy, speak on that. Pretty sinister.
Oh. Yeah, this splash page is hilarious. It has this cloaked figure with these gloved hands coming into his room while he's like half asleep, kind of peeking over his shoulder like, what is going on here? But the dialogue boxes are, you know, the caption boxes are the ones that really make this great. It says, 3 a.m. outside, the seemingly nonstop circus that is the Times Square area has finally begun to run down. Inside, in his live-in office above 42nd Street's Gem Theater, Luke Cage has been asleep for nearly 15 minutes until the sounds, not normal to the night, the surroundings, a soft footfall, the faintest creak of an opening door, and Luke Cage sleeps no more.
Wow, Archie Goodwin, man.
That's great.
What a writer. Fantastic. Yeah, that's some pretty good writing there from Archie. And then, you know, this is very sinister because this cloaked figure with those eyes, you know, Billy, it's very eerie the way his eyes look. And it's definitely looks like this is going to be a horror-type comic. Also, the Phantom of 42nd Street, you know, inspired by the Phantom of the Opera by Gaston mm-hmm. Leroux. So, of course, famous story, you know, reenacted here in the Gem Theater and not the Paris Opera House. Sort of,
yeah.
Minus the girl. Well, I mean, I guess you can count Dr. Claire Temple as the girl, but the Phantom just completely ignores her. And then mm-hmm. Luke is upset. But it seems at first that this Phantom has some supernatural powers, right, Billy? Because Luke wakes up, he says, "Don't know who you are, baby, but you picked the wrong pad to rip off." You know, and then, they start fighting. Now, this is a great... You know, a bit of wordplay here by Luke. Listen to this, Billy. He says, "Don't know who made it Halloween, Joker, but that little trick is getting you this for a treat." And then he punches into the cloth. But this, you know, guy definitely has some prestidigitation, this Phantom, mm-hmm. because he disappears, he reappears. At first, it seems supernatural, right, Billy?
Right, yeah. Well, we'll find out it's not supernatural later on, but for the time being, it seems that way. And yeah, he tries to punch this Phantom and it doesn't work, and then these hands just reach out and start choking him and throw him out the doorway, and he smashes into a desk, and he's pissed off. No follow-up. Must have figured between the choking and the chucking around I was done. Well, ghost, goblin, whatever you are, don't get too wrapped up in what you're doing there, because you and Luke Cage have just begun to tangle. And it shows this Phantom and he's like searching around this wall, looking for something, which is kind of weird because that gives you the thing like, okay, he didn't just come in here to kill him. He's actually looking for something. Like, what is going on here?
Yeah, exactly. Like, Luke, he expresses surprise that, you know, ever since his transformation, he's weighed upwards of 400 pounds, right, Billy? 450 mm-hmm. pounds. So that this Phantom would be able to pick him up and hurl him against the wall and then think that he's down for the count, that surprises him mm-hmm. too. But he's very surprised that this guy has this kind of strength. And then, the Phantom thinks he's taking care of Luke. So he's looking at this wall, like you say. Luke grabs him from behind. And then the hood slips off of the Phantom's head. And he sees this horrendous looking mask. I mean, this guy,
man,
it looks like he's been using acid as aftershave because
he's all burned up. Yeah.
Yeah. His face is green. His face is all messed up. Looks like a Steve Bissett or John Turtleman drawn, you know, soul from hell. And then he disappears, right? Because the sight of his ruined face, you know, it basically shocked Luke into immobility. And then he just, you know, pulls a fadeaway act. And then DW's knocking on the door saying, Luke, is that you crashing around in there? We've got trouble in the theater. We need you, man. And then it seems that, you know, moments before the Phantom showed up in Luke's apartment, he was also terrorizing the folks down in the theater watching a Western a movie, and they all ran for it. Yeah. And then he showed up in Luke's room, like you say, looking for something. He's trying to find something. Now,
yeah.
Now, Billy, this is one of the recurring in-jokes or the Luke Cage-isms that we find throughout his run, and even in the Power Man and Iron Fist comics. He doesn't have a shirt available to make himself presentable because what is Luke's kryptonite? What is his biggest bane, the bane of his existence?
Well, it's funny. He says, you know, hey, every time he's out, you know, doing his job, making some money, his shirt gets ripped up. So he always has to find another one and order more from the costume shop. And in the meantime, until he gets to the costume shop and can get his new order of shirts, he has to put on this other one.
Oh, man.
This one looks pretty cool, too. I like this one.
It's like a tank top, but, you know, it's clearly just a yellow shirt, you know, meant for the gym crowd that he bought or something for these emergencies, right? But it looks pretty cool. It looks, it's really good. It enhances his musculature even more, you know. But, Billy, there's this great bit. One of my favorite parts of a Marvel comic is I think it's in the Power Man and Iron Fist series in some one of the later issues where Luke, he goes to the, like right now he's ordering his shirts from this costume shop that he found the shirt in the very first time, but eventually he would order it from a professional tailor, and the professional tailor would have a call order for Luke so that every week or so he could pick up like a dozen or half a dozen shirts, you know. and so in the Power Man and Iron Fist series, there's this great bit where Luke walks into the store. And he says, I just came to pick up my shirts. And the guy gives him the shirts. And then there's a guy standing in line behind Luke, waiting, you know, for Luke to finish. Luke pays the man, the tailor, and he walks away. And then he's lost in thought. But then you hear in the background the tailor say, oh, hi, Dr. Banner. We've got your order of pants right here.
That's great.
You know, so the same tailor that supplies Luke's shirts that keep getting ripped up is the same guy who supplies Bruce Banner's pants and his clothes as well. So
that's a good joke.
Hilarious,
right there.
Man. Hilarious. So, you know, you've got DW like remembering that he better let his uncle Max know about this because there's been some damage done to the theater. Luke says, while DW's calling his uncle, he's going to investigate this hole in the screen. Now this is some great Archie Goodwin writing again. Listen to this, Billy. Downstairs in the movie theater, everyone has fled. Seekers after celluloid thrills, unprepared to face the intrusion of something more immediate, more real, but no less fantastic. Wow, that's some good writing there from Archie.
Well, we know Archie Goodwin's a great writer. I mean, maybe Luke Cage isn't the best fit for him or his style, but I gotta admit, he does a pretty darn good job, man.
Yeah, he does. No. He does on everything he's worked at, he's done a good job. But of course, I prefer his horror titles or his anthology style stories, shorter tales. But, you know, he's definitely one of the greats and one of the greatest editors, too, that comics have ever seen. Yeah, so. Yeah, but Luke, you know, there's more great writing to come, dialogue-wise and narrative style, because he's investigating the theater now, backstage, and he can't find any, you know, inkling or any, you know, clue based on where this Phantom might have gone. But we see the Phantom
watching
Luke through from this hidden doorway, and it seems that much like the Phantom of the Opera in the classic novel and in the movies, of course, this Phantom has access to secret tunnels and secret nooks and crannies and and hideaways and this vast underground system. In fact, later we'll learn linking the entire 42nd Street below ground.
Yeah.
So the Gem Theater, Gem Theater is just one of his many, you know, access points. And then, you know, we've got Luke deciding to take it outside, and he walks outside and he sees this doomsayer sporting this placard saying, "The end is nigh. Sin. This is a street of sin. Beware, the avenging spirits. I'll bring a doom." Why is he hanging out in you know, Times Square to say this? Shouldn't he be hanging out in one of the red light districts or something?
All I know is I only ever ran into one of those people. And it was when I was maybe 10 years old, and it was in Washington, D.C., and it was hilarious. He had a megaphone.
Yeah.
And he was spouting all sorts of wild stuff, man. It was crazy. And I remember being a little kid and being like, what's this guy on? You know, even at 10 years old, like, the guy was saying some really, like, radical stuff.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, holy crap.
Yeah, they're probably of the religious persuasion. I know New York had them in the 70s and probably in the 60s as well. But later on in the 80s, I think it sort of tapered off. But, you know, London still had them into the early 2000s, because when I was in London...
Wow.
Yeah, I lived there for 4 years, remember? So I saw a lot. Okay, my favorites were the buskers, but you have the odd street corner preacher. But then you also have a doomsayer, you know, a guy with a placard. But it's basically more political. You know, you have these guys, these almost looks like homeless people walking around with these placards. Not often. I would not see this every day I went, you know, to the tube. I would see this maybe once a month or maybe even less than that. But, you know, it's political based. It's guys standing there with signs saying that, you know, London's downfall because of the mayor's incompetence and stuff like that. So, you know, it was more, rhetoric, political rhetoric. But, you know, they were crazy, definitely, because once you get them talking, or once they see you looking at them and they think you're a sympathetic ear, yeah, they will spout some really crazy conspiracy theory level stuff.
Crap.
Yeah. Now, Billy, this is cool, because we see this guy again later on in the issue, and he looks like God, man. He looks like God with a hangover.
He looks scary. He looks scary, man. He looks like almost like, I actually at one point thought when we see him again later in this issue, like, and even Cage makes a comment like, maybe that's the Phantom, because this guy almost looks like a supernatural kind of being.
Yeah, he's looking for clues, and this guy's the closest to it, you know, so because he looks the part. Yeah. You're right, but then, you know, Cage is accosted by another character that will plague him. Well, it'll plague him every now and then, and that is Phil Fox, ace reporter for the Daily Bugle. Now, he must have shown up in a Spider-Man comic book, you know, as a peripheral character too, because... You know, you had a couple of Daily Bugle reporters, other than, you know, obviously Peter Parker being the photographer there, who would show up every now and then. Yeah, you know, you had like, you know, Lance Bannon from the Spider-Man comics when Roger Stern was writing them. And and of course you had this guy, Phil Fox, plaguing, you know, Luke Cage. And then later on, of course, you would get Eddie Brock, Venom. But he was more of a photographer like Peter as well. So, you know, that's what I liked. It was kind of like the Daily Planet over at DC. You know, you had this staff of reporters that would show up in the Marvel Universe. Phil Fox was one of them. And he's very, you know, paparazzi-like. He follows Luke around wanting to tell his story because Luke's the hottest new thing on 42nd Street. And Luke doesn't want this reporter to tell his life story. He doesn't want him digging into his past because he's an ex-con. An escaped, presumed dead convict. And, you know, he gets rid of the guy temporarily, but the guy promises he won't let this go. He never lets go of a story. And then Luke talks to DW, and DW says, you know, the wall where the Phantom was looking for something, it used to have this picture, this portrait of this man called Adrian Loring, who used to own... the Gem Theater and basically all the theaters on the block. All the entertainment joints on the block. So this guy, Adrian Loring, was a rich guy. And this was the face that Luke apparently saw You know, when he pulled off the cowl of the Phantom, this burnt face. But it can't be, because Adrian Loring would be dead many decades now. You know, so it's impossible for him to be him, because he would be like, if he was still alive, he would have been ancient. But apparently he died in a fire in the theater. Mm-hmm. So this sort of reinforces the supernatural theory here, right? That Luke's got running, that this guy might actually have powers.
Yeah, and then, oh man, I love that next panel. Luke Cage walking up the stairs, and there's a pair of legs right there. He's looking up at them like, whoa.
Damn. Foxy Brown came for a visit. Nope, it's Dr. Claire Temple. It's not Cleopatra Jones. Oh, man. Pam Grier, Billy. Pam Grier. Claire Temple is Pam Grier here. She's really based, I'm sure of it.
Sure.
Billy Graham must have based her off of Pam Grier, because Pam Grier was very big in 72. And
yeah, you figure, I think Coffee and some of those other ones had been out by now, I think. So yeah, she was already a, you know, making a name for herself in films.
Yeah. And then, you know, he goes to, well, Claire Temple's there. She needs his help. And she says she'll also buy him a coffee. They walk over to the clinic. She says, shares with Doc Bernstein, who is sort of Luke's father. You know, if you think about, you know, if he ever had a father, this guy's the closest to it, because he created
him. Right.
But this is a very weird panel, Billy. As soon as they arrive at the clinic, wow! They're met by a flying fastball special here, courtesy of whoever threw Doc Bernstein through the doorway, because Doc Bernstein just comes flying at Luke. He's being hurled, and Claire says, "Noah, good Lord." Yeah, Luke's a pretty good receiver, and he catches Doc Bernstein like a football. But then, you know, there's a patient that went berserk. So what happens next, Billy?
It's awesome. So Cage goes in to confront the guy, and the guy is huge. Like, he's even bigger than Cage. And the guy picks up this huge cabinet, and like, he's going to throw it at everybody. And Luke says, "Muscle man, I warn you." And the guy chucks it at Luke Cage, who just, of course, puts his arms up and blocks it, and it just smashes to pieces because, you know.
Yeah.
He's like almost invulnerable. And he says, "Baby, I ain't never been long on understanding. And you and I just, and I had for you just ran out. Time you got a little grief." Oh. And then all of a sudden, this little guy pops up out of nowhere.
Speaking French.
Diminutive guy. Yeah, speaking French, and calms the big guy down.
Yeah, basically, you know, this Haitian guy, this is the Haitian I referenced in the synopsis, he's a giant, towering above Luke, and he's also very strong, not supernaturally strong or unnaturally strong like Luke, but he can pick up a 200-pound cabinet like it was kindling and just hurl it at people. But he is part of this act, and this little guy who's a little person, a dwarf, he brought him in to have his hand fixed, because apparently this Haitian sprained his left hand. And he explains to Luke that the Haitian has had a bad experience with doctors in the past. And when Dr. Noah Bernstein tightened the bandage around his hand, he lost control. And he's mute. Yeah. He can't speak. So please be understanding. So Luke lets him go. But then Luke starts to suspect. This is now his burgeoning detective skills, right, coming to light here, Billy. I mean, he'll never be Batman, but Luke's got a good head on his shoulders, man. He's not educated, but, you know, if he had the opportunity, he would have been, you know, as smart as anybody else. He would have been Matt Murdock level style championing, you know, he could have become a lawyer or something. But I think Luke, you know, he's got this great, you know, he's very rational. You know, he doesn't believe in supernatural events, even though he's been scientifically altered. So he focuses on rational and logic and rationality first and foremost. And he sort of pieces the puzzles together, because what happens here? This guy is huge. He's got a sprained hand, which is the exact limb that the Phantom used to punch Luke when he accosted him the previous day. And then, you know, he also theorizes that this guy's strong, so he could have picked me up and hurled me against the wall like he did with the cabinet just now, last night. So, but then he sort of discounts that theory, because he says the guy that attacked me was even taller. Right, Billy?
Right.
And we'll find out, well, that's the reason behind it is crazy, but It's pretty cool. Yeah. It's pretty cool.
It's insane. But yeah, oh yeah. And then I like how we switch back to who was that? What's his name's office there? DW's office. And this old guy trying to hire Luke Cage to find out what's going on. He gets all snappy with Cage, and Cage just snaps the guy's cane in half.
Yeah, exactly. Now, this seems to be a guy called Mr. Brunt. He, okay, I don't know exactly how it works, but he's got some kind of, I mean, he owns most of the theaters and the entertainment venues on 42nd Street. And he's a co-owner of the Gem Theater, I think, along with DW's right. uncle. And that's yeah. why now he's upset with DW because of the damage done to the theater. And then, but also because of the damage done to many of his properties on 42nd Street, because the Phantom's been quite busy, right, Billy?
Yeah, just the whole night with Cage there that led off the issue wasn't apparently the first time this Phantom had been, like, wrecking places up and down 42nd Street that this old dude owns.
Yeah, now Cage has a meeting with DW and this old dude, Mr. Brunt, who's this real ornery little bastard, but, you know, and yeah. rude as all get out. I mean, he's obviously a rich guy. He's not used to be, you know, kept waiting. And Luke made them wait for an hour because he had to take a delivery. You know, he had to get his new shirts from the costume shop, which was on order. And then, you know, also he was refused entry by the security guard of the building. Didn't want to let him go up. Probably a racist.
Told him to go up the freight elevator.
Yeah, so that's a racist, right?
A
so,
jerk. Yeah.
Now, I wonder, I mean, it's when you probably see off-panel or something, or if this was a movie and you have, you know, the cuts that didn't make it into the movie, you would probably have Luke, you know, twisting a metal pipe around this guy, you know, tying him up or something, this racist, because Luke didn't stand for that kind of jive. But he snaps the cane of this old guy who's angry that Luke's late, because he waves the cane in his face. And then Luke says, come on, we're not working for this cat. We're lighting out. And then the old guy begs him to come back, which is just what Luke was waiting for. You got the sinister smile on Luke's face in this one panel, Billy, when this old guy scene starts to beg, right? Luke's saying, yeah, I know you go there. And then the old guy just head in his hands. He just says that this the face of the Phantom, he's seen it too. And, you know, he says that the thing is his partner or was his partner, Adrian Laurie, who co-owned all the properties around this area.
And then here we go outside with that crazy guy again.
Doomsayer right there with his placard screaming doom. And Gamora, all about me is Gamora, but I shall see it smited and consumed. That's where the god... you know, thing comes in. This is the, I think he based this appearance off of the biblical god.
Cage is watching this nutty guy and he goes, he was out last night, appearing right after the Phantom vanished. Could all that hair be hiding something else or something worse? According to my checking on Adrian Loring, his body was never found in that fire. So that's when Cage is kind of like, yeah, he's trying to figure this out, but it's not easy.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, the reporter... Phil Foxy accosts Luke again. He says he's going to tag along. And there's nothing Luke can do to stop him. But then Luke decides to sort of outwit him here. He jumps onto a fire escape or on a sign or something. And he just leaps up using his super strength to just, you know, pull himself up onto the roof in a double quick time. And leaving Phil Fox, high and dry down there. And then Luke takes to the rooftops. And then he spots his office window. And he sees the Phantom in there tearing up his office. Now, how many times has Luke's office been destroyed, Billy? Jeez, almost more than his shirts.
Yeah, it's a theme.
Yeah, definitely. And Luke smashes through the window here. He looks very Superman-esque as he leaps towards that window. That's a Superman pose.
For sure.
Like he's flying through the window there in one leap. And then he tackles the Phantom. But the Phantom again pulls a vanishing act. And leaving the gloves behind, and Luke rips the cape in two because the cape has been tripping him up.
And then, his dialogue there.
Oh, read that for us, man. That's great. That bodiless.
as he rips the cape in half, that bodiless, motherless hunk of ghost is making for my office closet.
Oh man. And then empty. But that can't be. So he realizes this closet has like a fake closet, well, fake door behind it, right? So he just like kicks it in, the kicks in the wall, and he discovers this network of tunnels leading from the gem theater mm-hmm. into the basement, down below into the sewers and all of that. And he crawls through these tunnels, right? But he's got a flashlight handy. And then mm-hmm. he gets into the storeroom, which is right below the Miracle Museum, which is mm-hmm. sort of like an arcade. It's a penny arcade, but, you know, it's got the storeroom beneath it, which houses all this carnival junk.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we see the face of this burnt face that's been plaguing everybody on 42nd Street.
Yeah.
And so Luke's discovered his hideout, the Phantom's hideout.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Phantom makes a run for it when Luke spots him. And mm-hmm. Luke says, "My man." That's exactly what he says.
Mm-hmm.
"You and that space outfit, you know, I'm glad you're keeping up appearances, Spooky, because those glow-in-the-dark threads make this hide-and-seek game a lot easier for me. Here I come, ready or not." And then what happens, Billy? Now we got the cover bit, you know, harkening back to the cover here. What does this Phantom do?
Yeah, he chucks a pinball machine down the steps at Luke Cage and all. Those are big, heavy machines, but he just, boom, kabrak,
now Billy,
smashes it.
You talk about John Buscema or Sal Buscema drawing a great punch, and, you know, they're very good with drawing figures in motion, in action. Mm-hmm. Look at how well Billy Graham drew this panel where Luke punched this.
Yeah.
He basically, with one punch, he smashes this pinball machine.
Shatters it to pieces.
Smithereens, yeah. Kabrak! But look at the way that Billy Graham drew that pose of Luke's. It's just a classic punch.
Well, yeah, and it's a great panel layout on that page, too. It's all different sorts of shapes, and that one's a triangular one there at the bottom. But yeah, great layout there.
Yeah, fantastic layout. It's very innovative. And then, you know, mm-hmm. you've got the next page filled with action. Luke's just cutting loose here. He's not holding back. He tackles the Phantom and in the process totals like half a dozen other pinball machines or arcade games there, arcade machines. And then, you know, that tackle basically knocked out the Phantom. Well, one half of the Phantom at least, because we see Luke ripping the mask off of the Phantom here. Or the like he calls them, the threads, and then he discovers the Haitian, the giant Haitian, unconscious, the one that he encountered in Doc Bernstein's clinic. But that's not all, because jumping off of the Haitian's head is the reason why he was a couple of feet taller when Luke mm-hmm. first met him. That's the little guy, you know, the little person. The little dwarf. He's a carnival you know, regular as well. He's just like the Haitian was a carnival strongman. It turns out that this little dwarf, what was he, Billy?
Armand the acrobat.
Yeah, Armand the acrobat. Yeah, he just took out Jacques, the strongman. But can you contend with Armand the acrobat?
I love it, though. It's really, he gives Cage a run for his money because he's like bouncing off the walls, like almost like Puck from Alpha Flight.
I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah, this kicking him in the face and stuff. It's great. And he knocks him into some electrical wires and then zaps him.
Yeah. Now, you know, when I first, this is a funny story, Billy. My original issue, which I'm not reading it now. I'm reading it in Masterworks, like I mentioned. But, you know, I have the original issue. My original issue has like some ink bled somehow, you know, it's the ink from the comic itself. I don't know how it happened, but it got smeared. So when he announced himself as Armand the Acrobat, and there's a spelling error too there that editorial missed, right? He says Actrobat, right?
Yeah.
But I thought now there's two funny things about this one little dialogue box here, because he says the other is his partner, Armand the Actrobat. The ink bled a little on my page so that the exclamation mark at the end of Armand looked like an I, you know, in my comic. Right. So I always thought this guy was an Italian. Armandi, the acrobat. So I thought, what is an acrobat? Okay, it's acrobat plus actor. You know, it's like an actor who's an acrobat. That's what I thought. Really, I thought this was intentional, but now I just think it's a spelling error. Acrobat. They meant to write acrobat because later he refers to him as just an acrobat again, right?
Right, so yeah.
I always thought this is a little Italian acrobat, Armandi.
Mm-hmm. I'm waiting for Mario and Luigi to come popping.
Exactly,
out of
man. Yeah. they were triplets. And then, you know, you got him kicking Cage in the face. And the reason why he's giving Cage a run for his money is he says he's got, you know, intimate knowledge of movement, the movement of the human body, you know, because he's been an acrobat for decades. And that's why he can turn Cage's own momentum and weight against himself, knocking him into this high voltage wire. And then he controls the voltage with this lever. And then he basically he's trying to murder Cage here, because Cage has got thousands of volts arcing through his body. And he's trapped, you know, by the convulsions. And then at first, Armandi wants to get information out of him. You know, where's the portrait? Where's the painting? I'm looking for the portrait from the office. I must have it. So that was his, you know, goal all along, to get that portrait. But Cage just, no way. No way, sucker. He doesn't say that. I'm just putting that in there. But anyway, and then Cage uses his super strength to, like, beat the convulsions. And he just punches the
electrical panel.
Yeah,
there.
The electrical panel, the fuse box, and boom, vzap, balom, and he made it. But Armandi or Armand, he's gone. So Billy, what happens then? We've got this, the clock tolling what, 3 a.m, bong bong bong. And what happens in the offices of Mr. Brunt?
Yeah, that Armand shows up. Or whatever, the little guy shows up and then pulls his mask off and basically tells the guy that he's going to take him out, because he wants the proof that, you know, he killed his father, because he said it was, you know, that was my father. That was his partner. So he's going to take the old guy out, and then the old guy pulls a pistol on him.
Yeah, and then, you know, he's going to blast him, because Armand's going to take him out mano a mano. In revenge for causing the death of his father. He killed his father. He didn't cause the death. He murdered his father to get the money, to get sole ownership of 42nd Street. And he's about to blast little Armand when Luke Cage comes barreling through the wall and with his open palm blocks the bullet. And the bullet just goes caroming off to the back there, right, Billy? Wow, that's fantastic. Nothing settled, Jive Mouth. Except that your hero for hire services are canceled. Badass.
That Brunt guy, man. He's talking some pretty nasty crap here. He says, the little guy says, I'll settle for this, taking you on alone to the death. And he has the pistol and he says, you'll settle for a bullet. You grotesque, bumbling little freak.
Jeez.
He calls the guy, and that's when Cage jumps in the middle of it. But not over yet, though. There's some dialogue back and forth, and Cage, you know, said he figures out what's going on, that, you know, Armand's father, you know, Brunt's old partner there, you know, he basically had him killed.
Yeah, you know? The truth comes to light here. And then, now look at that top panel on the last page there, Billy, the top leftmost panel, the way that Mr. Brunt is drawn. Doesn't that look like a Will Elder EC Comics drawing of an evil old man? You know, Will Elder.
Yeah, he looks creepy.
Damn. That looks like straight out of Will Elder there. And then, now that he's admitted his guilt, you know, Luke Cage says he's going to take him in to the authorities. But, you know, little Armand, he's not having it. He opts for immediate revenge, immediate satisfaction. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, that means both of them dying at the same time. And what does he do? He jumps towards Mr. Brunt, tackles him, and they both go flying out of the window to their deaths.
No. Yeah, they're all... Yeah, because they're like in this crazy office building that's like, I don't know if it's a skyscraper or not, but it looks like it's probably at least like 20 stories high.
Yeah, it's at least 20 floors, you're right. And you know, Luke had a great bit just before that where he sort of Agatha Christie style Hercule Poirot, you know, her famous detective outlines, you know, the plot, the scheme at the end of the tale for all the listeners to hear. Luke does this, you know, he says that, you know, the portrait contained the papers that were hidden by Armand's father that proved he had a share in the theater, and that it would all go to Armand here, because that was Adrian you know, the portrait of Adrian Loring, Armand's father, and then that's Luke putting those pieces together all by himself. I mean, DW didn't even help.
Yeah, pretty cool. But yeah, they go flying out the window, and Cage is just left to kind of, you know, figure here, you know, have his thoughts to himself here. But then he goes back downstairs to the street level, and here's that creepy
again.
The guy, yeah, with his
creepy
sign.
Doomsayer, looking like God, you know, after like a drinking
Moses
fit.
Or something. Moses, yeah.
Oh, or even looks like the Stranger. Do you know that character, Billy? That cosmic level. He looks like the Stranger. From Marvel.
Except his hair is like a little more blow dry, you know, blown out.
Could even be Odin on one of his many trips to Earth.
Oh yeah, when he's flipping out, and then Cage, the big doom, huh? Maybe someday it'll come, brother. Till then, looks like the everyday ones are gonna keep me in business a long time.
Yeah, because Cage has got no shortage of clients so far in his tenure. What, he's been a week at it? He's had a lot of clients.
He's in New York City, but oh boy! And then the blurb after that. What does that say?
Next, Black Mariah.
Oh, and if you don't know who that character is, oh, get ready! It's not Mariah Carey here, people. So get
no
ready.
Way, no Ooh, way. Boy. Although Mariah Carey's approaching her these days, but you know, I'm not going to fat shame anybody because I'm pretty rotund myself these days. But you know, Black Mariah, yeah, we're gonna get into her character and her look come next time, and it's very stereotypical, but
we're gonna try our best to dance around it without
offending people. Anyone. Yeah, but it's some good tough, good though. Times coming, Billy. Good times on the horizon here for Luke Cage. Some classic issues still on the on the docket. So fantastic issue from Mr. Cage, and we'll hit on straight into the next one, Billy. This is proving to be a lengthy episode. And but the next one is a little bit shorter. We've got Iron Fist again. Yeah. Marvel Premiere number 18. Iron Fist looking for revenge against Harold Meacham, who caused the death of his parents. So I'm going to quickly run through the details of the comic here. Marvel Premiere number 18, cover dated October 1974, on sale July 23rd, 1974, and edited by Roy Thomas. Cover penciled by Gil Kane. Inked by Jack Abel.
And, oh boy. Cain and Abel. Oh
Cain
boy.
And Abel. Hey! I didn't get that till now. Yeah, till now that you said it. Cain and Abel.
Boy.
One
House
of them's
of mystery,
gotta die.
House of Secrets. Yeah, I mean, boy.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, exactly. And you've got the name of this storyline, particularly interesting name, Lair of Shattered Vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
Which sounds just like a title someone came up because it sounds cool. Yeah, it does sound cool, but surprisingly on point, you know, for what's happening in the story. And then you've got writer Doug Munch, penciled by Larry Hama, inked by Dick Giordano, lettered by R.D. Simek, colored by Petra Skotis. And this, of course, can be found in Iron Fist Masterworks Volume 1, but also in the Essential Iron Fist Volume 1. And also the Epic Collection, The Fury of Iron Fist, trade paperback. One of the similar ones to the Luke Cage and Shang-Chi collections, right, Billy?
So yeah, I'm hoping they come out with a volume 2 soon, because I think this is the only one they have so far.
Yeah, I don't think they've got another one. Yeah, that's strange. They should have, because that'll wrap up the Iron Fist appearances until he meets up with Cage. He's got some great John Byrne stories still to tell. I don't own those Epic Collection, the first one myself. I just, you know, like the Masterworks format. But, they've completed the Iron Fist run in the Masterworks. But they've yet to do so in the collected paperbacks. So, but Billy, great issue here. What's your synopsis for Iron Fist? This is a vast improvement over the previous two issues that we've discussed.
For sure. So, after defeating an electronic-inspired opponent, Iron Fist comes face-to-face with the man that killed his parents. But after hearing the man's story, will he be able to kill him?
Very good one. Very good one. Right. I've got, after taking out Triple Iron, a reject from the upcoming Tron movie, the Fist finds Meacham at the top of the Tower of Death. Old Harold is a broken man, though, legless, bitter, and neurotic. He recounts his story to Danny, but is then promptly murdered by a Shokazugi ninja wannabe, leaving Iron Fist to take the rap. So, basically, between the two of us, we've covered everything that happens in this issue. Right? But we didn't mention Harold Meacham's daughter showing up at the very end. Very similar to what happens in the Iron Fist TV show, the Netflix Iron Fist, which wasn't very good, but I watched it, and some enjoyable moments where Iron Fist is blamed for something he hasn't done. And, you know, interesting issue, though. It's got some action in the beginning, but after that, the action sort of takes a backseat to the story as Harold Meacham tells his side of the tale of what happened after he killed, you know, Danny's father, Wendell Rand, and left them to die on the slopes of the Himalayas. So, Billy, though, cover-wise, what do you think about this cover?
It's not bad. You know, I think it's pretty cool. I do think it actually is better than a lot of the interior pages where it's the fight scene, to be honest with you. I do like it quite a bit.
Yeah, it's a good cover. It's Gil Kane covers. Mm. We love Gil Kane on covers, actually, we should mention. Although I'm not a fan of his interiors, but his covers are great. Composition-wise, art-wise, everything works on this cover. Of course, the cover's deceptive. There's no girl to rescue. And no. This girl appears to be naked, clothed in shadows, but she essentially appears to be naked, just the shadows covering her naughty bits.
It almost looks like she could have like a black one-piece bathing suit on here. You know, it kind of looks like a little bit
a bathing
the way
suit,
the shadows are.
Yeah, worn in this electronic tower of death. Weird.
She's a very attractive lady.
Oh yes, she's beautiful. Gil Kane could draw the ladies really well if he put his mind to it. You know, his ladies were always the best thing about his interiors for me. I love the way he draws ladies, but the rest, you know, for me is not that great. But you know, I shouldn't give Gil Kane too much flack here, because this cover is pretty great. And, you know, Iron Fist looks good. Look at his musculature, his lead, his Kung Fu style, you know, action pose. And then you've got the glowing fist, which is trailing this energy effect. I love it.
Yeah.
Now, this triple iron guy, though, Billy, I don't like him at all. This is just a crazy, stupid... This is not even, you know, funny in a weird way, which we love, you know, that we could laugh about. This guy's just a throwaway villain.
He's kind of lame.
He's very lame. And he's got a childlike mind, apparently, because he's been sequestered by Howard Meacham in this tower for one sole purpose for the last 10 years, apparently, and that is to protect him against Iron Fist. So, Lair of Shattered Vengeance, opening splash panel. This guy looks to be a giant compared to Iron Fist.
Yeah.
And yet, Iron Fist takes him out because Iron Fist figures out that the power effect, or this energy effect that his nunchucks has, which makes him deadly, it's sort of dependent upon whether his feet are touching the ground, because this room that he's in is basically his power source. And Iron Fist then realizes that once he can, you know, let the guy move around a little bit, that his power keeps cutting out. So not a very effective... you know, what would you say, weapon there that Harold Meacham gave this guy? It's not working.
No, And then the issue really picks up and gets really good and interesting when, like you said, you have Iron Fist come into Meacham's office, and the two of them talk, and Meacham goes into, like we said, what happens after he killed Danny's father.
Yeah.
He kind of, went to go his own way, and then fell off of a cliff because he started getting delirious. He didn't have any food or water.
Yeah.
And he fell off a cliff and blacked out, and then he got picked up by a couple people, right?
Yeah, he picked up by Sherpas, who took him to a Tibetan village, and then he woke up to realize he's legless because the frostbite took his legs, and they had to amputate. And so he's now, you know, paraplegic. He's a broken man. And that's where the Shattered Vengeance part comes in, right, Billy? This is Iron Fist looking for vengeance, but vengeance has already been had. Karma has sort of worked his way. Not that I believe in that kind of stuff, but if you want to, let's call it that. It's worked its way. It's had its way with Harold Meacham. He's lost both of his legs. But then a very weird thing happens. One of the Tibetan monks show up to brag about his time in Kunlun to the folks taking care of Meacham. He says, It's real. Kunlun, the ancient city, is real. It materialized, and I was privileged enough to visit, to be allowed to walk the streets, escorted by the honorable, august personage in jade himself, Yuti. And I witnessed the training of a young foreigner who they rescued. So Hiram Meacham now suddenly all ears, right? Like this young foreigner that's been rescued. And then this is where Meacham's fear and paranoia were born, because this monk continues his tale and he says, "This young foreigner is inordinately dedicated to his studies and the martial arts. He's driven by something beyond the ken of the rest of us, driven to succeed." So Meacham knows this is the drive for revenge. You know, he knows this is the young Danny that's been rescued and picked up. And then Meacham went back to civilization once a cart arrived to take him back to Kathmandu or something. And then from there on, he spent a fortune preparing his building, his tower, to stop Danny from seeking revenge against him, to basically. But then at the end, he wants to die because his life is over. It's been shattered. His legs are gone. He's an old man now. He's bitter. He's neurotic. His body's failing him. But Iron Fist then does the worst thing that Meacham could conceive of. Instead of being merciful and kills him, what does he do, Billy?
He actually is shedding a tear, and then he kind of, because it's a sad story, and he just feels like he's not going to be able to kill this guy because this guy's story is so sad. So he just turns and walks out, and then Meacham grabs a pistol to try to shoot him, and just as he's pulling the trigger, something hits him in the hand and makes the shot go off target.
Yeah, the shuriken that's been hurled by this mysterious benefactor of Iron Fist, the savior that saved him on more than one occasion. I mean, he also saved him, from basically, well, not really saved him. He allowed him to enter another room earlier during his fight with Triple Iron by hurling a shuriken into a niche in a wall, right, Billy? And then pointing the way for Iron Fist to lure Triple Iron into this room where he took him out with electrical wires. Similar to Armandi's plot with Luke Cage with the electrical wires. But then we've got this ninja type, like I say, very Shokozugi-esque, showing up, and he ruined the aim of Meacham. And then, Iron Fist's been winged, though. Yeah, I mean, the bullet grazed his skull, so he's
It did.
temporarily passed out. But when he comes to, this is a horrific bit,
Oof.
right, Billy? I mean, we don't,
Nasty.
it's not sugar-coated here. Can you describe what he sees in the office of Meacham after he comes to?
Yeah, there's Meacham slumped over in his wheelchair, and then it shows a close-up, and Danny's like right in front of Meacham, and the guy's sword is shoved right through the guy's chest and through the back of his wheelchair. Oof, nasty.
Oof. Damn, man, that's bad. That's horrible. We see the blood dripping from it from behind the wheelchair, where he was impaled. And then Danny's hanging out there for a bit to I don't know what he's doing, but he's like he's there for longer than he should be, right, Billy? Just staring at the corpse. And then Meacham's daughter shows up. Oh no, and now she blames Iron Fist for the death of her father because she finds him there red-handed. She's thinking he's the murderer. And she knew about it because her father told her about the possibility that this kid, this Danny Rand, would come to murder him. And Iron Fist she beats on his chest. He restrains her, but then he leaves, and she swears that she'll spend a fortune. She'll send thousands of men after him, but she'll get him. She'll kill him. And Danny can do nothing but leave, right? So a vastly improved issue here from Larry Hama. Even the pencils were better than previous issues. And of course, Doug Munch, fantastic writer. I think he really found his footing here, although he won't be on the title for long. But yeah, he really gave us a good story this time around, right, Billy?
Yeah, absolutely. This was my favorite of the bunch so far.
Yeah, definitely. And then next issue, The Mystery of Meacham's Murderer, A New Life for Iron Fist, and more in the story called Death Cult. So the next story is actually a good tale as well. So it's very enjoyable. We get more characters, scenes here. We get to meet someone who's going to become a mainstay of the Iron Fist mythos, I should say, if you can call it that. You know, so yeah, there's more characters being introduced, more you know, side characters, more supporting characters for Iron Fist. That's important for any series. So far, we haven't had them, right, Billy? So once Iron Fist gets them, we'll get to meet some great characters along the way.
Well, for sure.
Yeah, look forward to some greatness here. So, but that brings us to the end of another episode, right, Billy, of Dragons and Jive. This is a lengthy one, almost 2 hours. We hope you listeners haven't fallen asleep. We hope we've kept you entertained, our patrons. And a big shout out to our patrons, right, Billy, to everyone, too.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening, you know, and for the support. I'm off to watch a couple of movies today since I've got some free time, Billy. I don't know how you're going to finish out your day.
Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do is I'm going to start getting ready to pack up the care packages for our top tier subscribers on Patreon. So look forward to that. Not too terribly long. Hopefully within a week, 2 weeks top of these episodes dropping, you guys will get your care packages.
That's right. And I finished up some Bronze Age monikers that I'm dropping on the newest episode of Into the Weird. I've finished up two so far, but we're doing, you know, chronologically, as the patrons signed up, we'll have them debuting on each regular episode of Into the Weird. So yeah, Billy, we're getting things rolling. The clocks are you know, working, and the cogs are turning, and everything's falling into place with our patrons. So we couldn't do that without our patrons. So thanks for you guys, and I hope you know, you're still enjoying listening to our shows, because you and I, Billy, we're having a blast recording them.
Oh, absolutely.
But with that, you know, we're out of here. Keep it cool, you know, when you're walking the streets of Harlem. You know, don't fear, because Luke Cage is near. He'll probably help you out for a fee. And don't go sniffing that mimosa. And then you should be fine and ready for the next episode of Dragons of Jive. So with that, Billy, I'm saying goodbye. We'll catch you soon on the download, listeners.
Take care, everybody.
Cheerio.